This program was produced by and first broadcast on Radio Kidnappers, a volunteer-based community access station. For more information, go to www.radiokidnappers.org.nz. Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this program available through funding the Access Internet Radio Project.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine,
You're listening to Radio Kidnappers, the voice of Hawke's Bay, and I'm Lynn Trafford, presenting on behalf of the Hawke's Bay branch of the Royal Society of New Zealand, Hawke's Bay Scientists on Air. This program is your opportunity to get to know recently retired and practicing scientists from around the bay. With me in the studio, I have Dr. Kathleen Kosniak, the Principal Scientist for Climate and Air in the Environmental Science Section of the Hawke's Bay Regional Council. Welcome to Radio Kidnappers and Hawke's Bay Scientists on Air, Dr. Kathleen Kosniak.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
It's lovely to have you with us, Kathleen. Are you a Hawke's Bay girl?
I am indeed.
Excellent.
Born
and bred in Napier. Where did you go to school, Kathleen?
High school, you mean?
Yes.
That was Sacred Heart College.
Sacred Heart. And was there a time when you were at Sacred Heart that you thought, climate, earth science, weather, this is definitely me, I want to study this, or did it all happen kind of later?
I certainly, at high school, developed an interest in earth science and kind of particularly meteorology, but the whole sort of earthquake, volcanology, all that kind of side
quite
of things.
Quite a sexy cell, isn't it?
Really? Yes. Especially like when you live in Napier, you know, experiencing earthquakes, you've got a natural interest. I did have other things that I thought about doing as well, so it was one of those things that just kind of fell into place.
It just happened.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. They must have been really pleased at Sacred Heart when you decided this was what you were going to study. I would have think that would be quite good for them.
I think, that was part of it, I think, in terms of, like I say, other interests, because I actually loved English.
Oh.
And
will come in handy for writing theses later on
yes.
in life. I'm sure that you'd write them correctly then.
Yes, yeah, I really enjoy creative writing, but to a certain extent, I felt that I was being encouraged.
Good. So you were encouraged to go to university then by your school. Where did you go to university?
University of Waikato.
Off to Hamilton from Napier. What did you decide to study for your degrees that you were doing there?
I did Earth Science, Bachelor of Science in Earth Sciences, and there was kind of an extra program with that called Environmental Planning. So that I think that's pretty much the time where the whole sort of Resource Management Act was coming into being.
Yep.
So that part of it kind of prepared you to go into the workforce to deal with that sort of thing.
It's quite a nice mix, really, and one that I wasn't expecting when you first talked about science with me. I wasn't quite expecting the planning. I don't know why I wasn't, but I think that it sits together quite nicely, doesn't it?
Yes.
And you could write about it then and use your English.
Yeah, that's right. I think the whole idea was, you know, it was that steering you down towards the assessing of environmental effects of activities kind of thing. So you kind of had that science knowledge and also the framework of the law around it, the whole sort of planning, the ethics around it. So, yeah, it was quite a nice...
Yeah, nice mix. Whilst you're at Waikato, did you get a chance to work on anything specific that you could tie into your study or was it too general?
It was lovely that it was very broad-based, so you did have all those sort of law, economics, ecology, earth sciences, and I mainly went down the route of hydrology and coastal marine geology, that kind of thing. For some reason, not so much down the stratigraphy and tectonics and the volcanology side of it. Then in the, like, you're doing masters and doing your thesis, that again was when I sort of picked up more again this interest in atmospheric science, which wasn't a big part of your actual sort of lectures and study. It was just a little bit of it, but that was what I did my thesis on, just a New Zealand perspective, a stratospheric ozone depletion kind of thing. So that was kind of that first turn into doing something more focused on atmospheric type.
A very definite move. So why did you come back to Napier? When you finished your master's then, how did you think you were going to use this by coming back to Napier? Or did you not even think about using it?
Not so much the thesis, just more that whole degree and in getting into that assessment of environmental effects of activities. Essentially, I came back here while I was just finishing off my thesis, you know, bludgeoning off the parents while I was finishing, and also managed to just get some part-time work at the Regional Council, just doing some, like, data processing and filing type stuff. And then the opportunity came up to be this resource consents officer, which was essentially what my degree kind of was preparing me for.
So it's a good apprenticeship, really, I suppose, if you can call it that way, isn't it?
Yeah.
It does allow you to find your feet, I guess, doing that sort of thing, does it? Was anything particular happening around the bay at that time, do you recall?
Probably my biggest consent that I was involved with was the motorway crossing of the estuary.
Oh, okay. Oh, yes. Well, that would be.
Yes. Yeah. That was quite a big deal at the time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that was a good experience, kind of, you know, environment court and all that sort
of. Yeah, it finds your feet, doesn't it? And it also introduces you to a lot of people going through a process.
Yes, it does, actually.
Not always people you want to get to know, but anyway, during that process, you're meeting all sorts of people, which is quite a good thing to do. I'm sorry, I was a wee bit flippant there. Anyway, you stayed in that role for 3 years.
Yes.
Then you decided that really you needed to round off your study again.
Yeah, I just realised that that being a consents officer wasn't quite at the point in the process that I wanted to be. I wanted to be more at the science end, as opposed to the consents officer was more kind of the liaison between science and everyone else, really.
That's right.
And just packaging that science into something digestible that you could kind of pull all the social and science kind of strands together to actually assess the impacts of an activity. So I found that I wanted to be more at the science end. So I thought I would just maybe try and get a change in direction. I thought I'd just either just go overseas and do the big OE or, try and get that change in direction.
And for you were lucky enough to be able to stay and study, weren't you?
Yeah, because I went to Bristol. Irish passport, yeah. I just temped in London and managed, luckily, to get a job with a science journal publisher. And from there was able to see all the kind of jobs and studentships on offer. And
it's quite slimy, really, isn't it?
Get a job to look for somewhere.
Look for the best job while being paid to look. Wow, okay, all right. So what happened? What did you decide to do?
I applied for everything and anything.
Oh, did
you? And so I applied for the studentship. It was initially at Manchester, actually. People were at Manchester, but they were on the move to Bristol. And so, I had to go for an interview and stuff. But, managed to land this studentship.
And you stayed there for 5 years?
Yes.
So what were you doing, Kathleen?
I was doing, I think the thesis was called, recall it properly, it's quite convoluted, Integrated Mesoscale and Hydrological Modelling for Flood Forecasting.
Right, so we're talking about rainfall and floods. Basically, and lots
rainfall,
of water.
Yeah, forecasting rainfall for sort of, assessing flood potential kind of thing.
Which at the time the UK was quite good at, too, wasn't it?
Yeah.
They had some nasties come in at that time, but anyway, that's enough about the nasties. The PhD study, during your PhD studying, what sorts of things were you practically looking at? That was the theory. What were you practically looking at for this PhD study?
Essentially, what we were trying to do was get a middle ground between a very basic form of forecasting, which is to get the radar images that everyone now seems to be, quite familiar with.
Yes, we see it on TV.
And just getting the past history, the movement of those, like, rain cells, and just carrying them forward. So that's a simple way of doing a forecast, just getting their sort of past direction and speed and pushing them onward to get your next forecast for in the next, you know, hour or two.
What did you learn from all that? Because that's a lot of data watching or data collecting, I suppose. So what were you learning from it?
Essentially, well, that helped sort of help give you an appreciation of how rain cells kind of moved and with the flow of the year and how they grew and dissipated. Because what we were then trying to do with those radar cells, rather than just rain cells, was rather just move them in that kind of simple form of forecasting, was to get more of the evolution in terms of the growing or decreasing or and a better feel of, you know, they don't always move in a straight line, so what kind of does get them to go in different, you know, turn in a different direction. So it sort of, that enabled me to really delve into sort of the theory of meteorology, the whole sort of dynamics, and looking at, because we wanted that middle ground between this very simple form and the very complex models that take supercomputers to run, just in trying to incorporate elements of that, those more complicated models, but not the full shebang.
Was it tempting to stay over there? Once you had done your PhD study, was it tempting to become a European girl, or why did you come back?
I did have the opportunity, got a Marie Curie fellowship to go and continue basically working on kind of thing I was doing, but I was sort of applying it in France and other parts of Europe, which, you know, did really appeal.
in terms of
we know the location and being able to do that, but he kind of got by. I had kind of at that point felt I'd gone as far as I could with that particular point in study, I was kind of a little bit
ready for
looking
something
for something else.
And then
I knew I was really interested in meteorology, so I was kind of looking at New Zealand Met Service website quite a bit, and discovered that they had jobs going for trainee meteorologists, which don't come out every year kind of thing.
No.
And it's quite, you know, there's only one organisation in the whole of New Zealand, so
that's
it's quite
right.
a select kind of...
And you would have been sitting pretty for it at that time, wouldn't you?
Well, I hoped I had a good chance.
Yeah, and you obviously did, because that's what happened, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Back you came.
Back
All
I
right.
came.
Can you explain for us... briefly, because we want to move on from that, but you were there for 8 years. What is it? What is a forecaster? What does a forecaster do there?
Essentially, you're just you're pulling in, because you've got information coming at you from these days from you've got all, millions. You've got untold observations now from all your local climate stations, from your buoys, from your ships. You've got the radar, rainfall. You've got your satellite pictures. You've got your model fields. So it's just really pulling all that together into sort of a coherent story, and looking at, particularly with the modelling, you've got about three models that you look at, and you've got to decide which ones, you know, because they're not all telling the same story for the future. So you've got to kind of decide which one is the most likely story to happen in the future. So you really want to test that model against the current observations and also against each other, just to say, you know, if there's two that are green and one doesn't, well, you're kind of more likely to go with the two that are green rather than the one that isn't kind of thing. So you just... pulling all those observations together, and what the models are suggesting will happen in the future, and basing, you know, your forecasts on that sort of information.
How many of you were doing this? How many forecasters does the Met Service, generally speaking, have?
I'm trying to remember. I think it might be about 50 or something.
It's quite a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, you are, because it's a 24/7 operation, so it's a lot of shift work, and you've got various sections. You've got sections dedicated to aviation forecasting, to marine forecasting, and then you're more your public that you see on the TV and get in the newspaper. And then you sort of got your lead forecasters that set the tone for the day, and your mesoscale expert forecasters that really look at the severe weather and forecasting that quite accurately.
So it's quite a big organisation.
Yes.
Good. Good, good. So you were there 8 years. Then you got the opportunity to come back to the Bay.
Yes, just, it's a great job, met service, but like I say, it's shift work, which takes a toll on your health and your body.
It does.
Some people, seem quite suited to it. They quite love it. But I kind of found it a bit hard going. And I love Wellington City, but the weather's not. Well, it's a real challenge for biking and that sort of thing.
It's the forecasters, really. If they could just get their models right, maybe the weather. Anyway, back you came.
Back I came
to the regional council for your role as climate and air scientist. Now let's define these two bits of your role, Kathleen. Climate in Hawke's Bay, I kind of look at it and think it's a bit temperate. Air quality in Hawke's Bay, I think it's a bit improving. But hey, that's just me, and I just sit and watch all this. What really is climate in Hawke's Bay?
You're right, it is pretty temperate. I mean, all of New Zealand, compared to places, there's the main continents, Europe, they have quite extremes in their temperatures and their dry periods and their wet periods. But here, even just, looking at rainfall, while we do get we get more rainfall in winter than summer, the distribution isn't that extreme. We sort of, there's not a whole lot of difference between summer and winter.
Uh-huh.
Sort of, not like other places in the world that get quite,
Not even like Auckland or Wellington, really, is there? Auckland rain is so much harsher than ours when it occurs, really. Anyway, and what about our air quality? Is that improving?
That is improving.
It is.
It's been great, actually.
All right. Let's get inside it a little bit now. Recently, I talked to you about climate change. Do we have change or maybe trends in our regional climate, or do we just think maybe we do?
Looking at temperatures, there does seem to be a warming trend, and there have been studies into changes in rainfall, but no statistically significant trend, essentially to date, I think, has been found in rainfall.
Is our rainfall the same across the Hawke's Bay region? And to answer that, really, maybe I should get you to explain to our listeners what is the Hawke's Bay region that you look at, and then do we experience differences across it?
Well, the region extends from sort of north of Wairoa, not quite Gisborne, but sort of a halfway line between Wairoa and Gisborne. And then it extends out to all, Lake Waikato Moana, the Uruweras, the Kawikas, the Ruinhienes, down to past the Waipak, and then, back out to the coast and up here. So you certainly get a gradient in rainfall from near the coast out to the ranges. Near the coast, it's probably about 700-800 millimetres a year. Out on the ranges, it's kind of 2.5 2,500 mils kind of thing. So certainly that ranges to the plains. There's a definite gradient there.
In the overall scheme of things, though, for New Zealand, is that a significant difference, or does it not count?
It's useful for us in that the greater rain around the ranges helps feed our rivers and our aquifers kind of thing, rather well,
We need that.
For the plains, we need that.
Sure do.
But certainly, the more you get more extreme, like rainfall down the west coast of South Island.
We talk also in the Bay from time to time, oh, it was a terrible, terrible drought, or, oh gosh, the drought was so severe this year. But do we get severe drought, or do we just think we do?
It's all relative, really, isn't it? I mean, if you hear about the Australians and they're in drought for years end. So, I mean, they cause hardship.
They do,
In that sense, yes. I mean, they can be a severe
But on the same token then, if you flick that round, we also talk about the storm of such and such a year as being a real doozy of a storm, or buckets of rain and the effect of the rain on our land and on our lives when we do get a really bad storm. Mm. But do we get many storms?
We get our main sort of real rain producers are those ex-tropical cyclones that make their way down here. So we probably do get, you know, one of those every few years, yeah, kind of thing, giving us a real...
Well, I guess we're lucky that we don't get too many of them.
Yeah.
Kathleen, is there a link between climate and air quality?
Oh, certainly. Certainly.
Okay, so what do we look for then?
Certainly our air quality, like in winter, it's those very still days where you end up with a very calm winds, a beautiful blue sky sort of a day, and then at night you quickly lose your heat from your ground and you get a temperature inversion, and that tends to trap pollutants close to the ground. So that's when we're all sort of burning our fires on those cold, chilly nights. And that's when we get a problem. So, you know, if it's a windy day and we're all burning our fires like that, you won't get a problem.
It'll just brushes
it'll get
away.
Dispersed, yes. But, yeah, on those still cold nights. But essentially, you know, the problem is ours because, you know, cold still night, we won't have an air quality problem if we're not emitting a lot of particulates out of our fires.
We see on TV from time to time ghastly instances of really bad polluted air in parts of the world. China, for example, when you maybe don't see the sun for days and days on end. So I really do need to ask you, have we really got a problem in the Bay, or do we just think we have a problem in the Bay?
Again, it is all relative, and yes, the likes of Beijing, China, that's quite phenomenal. But we do, I mean, there are health quality standards out there, and they're out there for a reason, and we do exceed them a few times during winter. So,
and going back to our region that you defined for us just a wee few minutes ago, does our air quality differ across our region?
Certainly, yes. Our main problem areas are the Napier and Hastings, the main urban centres. We've done some monitoring in the likes of Waipukareao, Waipawa, Wairoa, and you do know, you know, particulate levels do get elevated during winter, but just not to the same extent as they do in the main urban centres.
And you mentioned then that we are doing air quality monitoring. What is the monitoring? What does one do? What do you collect?
What the instruments do is draw air through an inlet, and they pass it over a filter, so you're collecting all the particulates that are in that air, and then you're measuring what the levels of those particulates on the filter.
So how many places do you do this across the region, and are you doing it across the whole region?
We have at the moment got permanent sites at Napier Hastings and Awatoto. And then we just kind of rotate an instrument around some of these other, like the smaller rural towns.
And the changes in technology that we have these days, if we go back, say, 30 years, the technology that was being used for data analysis then, you cannot compare with the sorts of technology that we are using today. So what are you learning from today that we didn't know in the past?
It's quite... particularly in air quality, there was just a real lack of measuring, really.
We didn't bother?
Particularly in Hawke's Bay, I don't think there was quite the awareness of the problems it can cause, really.
Yes.
Yeah. So, it's probably really in the past 10 years that we've been really sort of monitoring with any real intent.
Okay, so that's quite a short period of time,
isn't
it?
So it is kind of hard to get trends and things out of it.
It's something that's going to happen, I guess, more in the future, isn't it?
Yeah.
Trends across 10 years is just not enough, isn't
no,
it?
It's
no. just not enough. That means, though, it's going to keep you busy for quite some time, does it not?
Could well do.
You will be so busy, you won't be able to skive off and do yet more study in Europe somewhere. You'll have to stay with us a wee bit longer. So on behalf of the Hawke's Bay branch of the Royal Society of New Zealand and of Radio Kidnappers, Thank you, Kathleen Kosniak, for being my guest on Hawke's Bay Scientists on Air. To find out more about the Royal Society of New Zealand, Earth Science, Sciences, weather forecasting, or the work being carried out as regards climate and air quality at the Hawke's Bay Regional Council, a Google search will assist in the first instance and keep you busy for hours and hours. Please join me again on the second and third Mondays of the month at 9:30 in the morning to meet another practicing or recently retired Hawke's Bay scientist. I'm Lynn Trafford.
This program was produced by and first broadcast on Radio Kidnappers, a volunteer-based community access station. For more information, go to www.radiokidnappers.org.nz. Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this program available through funding the Access Internet Radio Project.